Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley and Brian Lynn bring us a story about child soldiers in Yemen.
For 2 years, Mohammed fought with Yemen's Houthi rebels against a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia and backed by the United States. Mohammed says he tortured and killed people. He did not care whether he lived or died. But if he did die, the bracelet he wore with a jihadi number would guarantee his body made it home. Mohammed is one of 18 former child soldiers who spoke with the Associated Press. All of them escaped from rebel forces or were captured by coalition units. They are now at camps and a counseling center in the city of Marib, in an area controlled by the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed coalition.
Both sides in the 4-year civil war have sent children into battle, a violation of international human rights conventions. The United Nations was able to confirm that 2,721 children have been recruited to fight for all sides in the conflict. A majority of them have fought for the Houthis. But officials say that number is likely low because many families are too fearful to speak out. A senior Houthi military official admitted to the AP that the rebels have brought 18,000 child soldiers into their army since 2014. He did not wish to be named. Officially, the Houthis say they do not recruit children and send away children who try to join. But in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, now under Houthi control, locals say the rebels go door to door, telling parents they must either turn over their sons or pay money for the war effort. Some of the former child soldiers told the AP they joined the rebels willingly because of promises of money or the chance to carry a weapon. But others described being taken from their schools or forced to join the Houthis in exchange for a family member's release from detention. Some children gave themselves a war name after they joined the fighting. One 10-year-old boy, for example, called himself Abu Nasser, Arabic for Father of Victory. A 13-year-old boy named Salah told the AP that Houthi fighters came to his home and demanded that he and his father come with them to the front lines of battle. He said his father was pulled away when he refused the order. Salah added, "I heard the bullets, then my father collapsing dead."
New recruits are usually taken first to culture centers for religious courses, which last about a month. They are told they are joining a holy war against Jews and Christians and Arab countries that have been influenced by the West. The boys are told that if they die fighting, they will go to heaven. Mohammed said, "When you get out of the culture center, you don't want to go home anymore. You want to go to jihad." The recruits are then sent to military training camps in the mountains. At night, they sleep in shelters made of tree branches. During the day, they learn how to fire weapons, plant explosives, and avoid missiles fired by coalition airplanes. After less than a month of military training, they are sent to war, wearing the bracelets meant to promise to honor them as martyrs if they die. The children call the lettering on the bracelets their jihadi number. Many child soldiers can be seen holding AK-47 machine guns at search areas along main roads in northern and western Yemen. Others are sent to the front lines as foot soldiers.
Mohammed fought in and around the city of Taiz. One day, the Houthis captured a coalition fighter. Mohammed was told to send electric shocks through the man's body during questioning. When it was over, he said, his commander gave this order: get rid of him. Mohammed said he took a heavy metal tool, heated it with fire, and then hit the back of the man's head. "He was my master," Mohammed said. "If he says kill, I would kill. I would blow myself up for him." A 13-year-old named Riyad said he and his 11-year-old brother once shot and killed two enemy soldiers. But more often, he said, he closed his eyes when he fired his gun. "Honestly, when I am afraid, I don't know where I am shooting. Sometimes in the air, and sometimes just randomly," he said. Riyad said half of the fighters he served with on the front lines were children. He said he asked his commander to let them take cover during airstrikes. "Sir, the planes are bombing." The commander's answer, he said, was always, "Followers of God, you must attack." I'm Brian Lynn.
What do these six words have in common? Hot dog, fireworks, well-being, waistline, sunset, and ice cream. They could all describe a fun holiday celebration. For example,
my holiday was wonderful. I went to a friend's party and we laughed, ate, and had a lovely time. We grilled hot dogs and made ice cream. Then, after sunset, we all went down to the river to watch the fireworks. It was a great time, but probably terrible for my waistline.
Great story! But what is the grammatical connection between all the words we talked about? They are all compound nouns, and that is our subject today. A compound noun is a noun made by putting two or more words together to act as one noun. These nouns can be written as one word, as in fireworks and waistline, as hyphenated words, as in well-being, or as separate words, as in ice cream. Compound nouns often have different meanings from their separate words. For example, if you had never heard of a hot dog, you probably would not know its meaning just from the words hot and dog. A hot dog is a small cooked sausage usually made from beef or pork. Compound nouns often are constructed from two parts of speech. The most common are noun plus noun, as in ice cream, waistline, and fireworks, which you heard earlier in the program. Adjective plus noun, as in hot dog and greenhouse.
Greenhouses at botanical gardens carry plants from around the world.
And noun plus verb, as in sunset and rainfall.
The average yearly rainfall in Washington, D.C. is around 40 inches.
But compound nouns are also formed in other ways, such as noun plus preposition, as in passerby.
A passerby witnessed the car accident on 17th Street.
Gerund plus noun, as in swimming pool and washing machine.
I'm so glad that our hotel has a swimming pool.
Adjective plus verb, as in public speaking and dry cleaning.
Can you call and see if the dry cleaning is ready?
Verb plus preposition, as in take off and look out.
Flight attendants, please prepare for takeoff.
And preposition plus verb, as in output and overthrow.
The company increased output by extending its office hours.
Okay, moving on to plurals and possessives. In most plural compound nouns, the S goes at the end. But here's a little more to know. If the compound noun has no space or does have a space in between words, the S usually goes at the end, such as in greenhouses, waistlines, washing machines, and swimming pools. If the compound noun has a hyphen or hyphens, the S usually goes at the end of the noun, such as in secretaries general, passers-by, and fathers-in-law. To make the possessive form, simply add an apostrophe S to the end of the complete word, such as in these examples.
My daughter-in-law's dress is being made. The dry cleaner's address is on the table.
Lastly, let's talk about stress. In spoken language, stress is giving greater loudness or force to part of a word. Correct stress is very important for compound nouns. We usually stress the first syllable. For instance, when I say the word fireworks, I put greater loudness on fire. If I put the stress on works, it changes the meaning and would confuse the listener. Not all compound nouns follow the rule of first syllable stress. Proper nouns that are more than one word are considered compound nouns, and they usually carry the stress at the start of the second word. Listen for the stress in these proper nouns.
New Orleans, Las Vegas, Mount Rainier, Grand Canyon, South Africa, New Zealand, Secretary General, Prime Minister.
By now in your English studies, you've already used many compound nouns, and surely you'll use many more. So practice ones that are useful to you in speaking and writing. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast, using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers, who knew about war, were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it had failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only 1 of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malton in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.